Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight I'm going to be talking to Laird Scranton about his latest book on Scarab Ray. And that one goes all over the place as it connects to so much stuff and so much stuff he's done in the past. Really a fascinating bit of work and a great book. I highly recommend it. There is a Patreon-only segment with him I will be putting up later in the week. We did have some Skype issues on this talk. I don't know what was going on. I've been able to clean most of them up in editing, but there's still a little bit of digital issues that you'll hear now and again, and there's really nothing I can do about it. I don't think it takes away from the interview, but that is what was going on whenever you hear a little bit of garbled for a second. Skype was just not cooperating whatsoever. And remember, you can go to www.wheredidtheroadgo.com to check out all the shows in our archive back to day one. They're all free. If you want to become a patron and get some extra stuff, there's a link there for that. It's only $3 a month. I do realize there are some issues with some of the links in the archive, or just on the page in general. The system we used to create the website did an update, and a lot of stuff got screwed up. And I've been trying to fix it, but there's a lot of stuff to go through and fix. So if you find something that's not working, feel free to shoot me a message. Contact at wheredidtheroadgo.com. If you have a story you want to tell us on the air, or just want to talk to us in general, again, contact at wheredidtheroadgo.com, or stories at wheredidtheroadgo.com if you have a story you want to talk about on the air. If you have some music you'd like to have in the outro at some point, like to be considered for us to put in the outro, that would also be contact at wheredidtheroadgo.com. So, get in touch with us, you know, and I thank everyone who has already submitted stories. I'll be getting in touch with people in January. I'm hoping to have a semi-regular segment on listener stories, as well as continuing the movie podcast, and at the end of January, I may have a brand new thing for people. If everything works out, it'll be something very, very cool, and that'll hopefully be at the end of January, which will be our fourth anniversary. So, perfect. All right. Without any further ado, here's my talk with Laird Scranton. All right, and I am speaking with Laird Scranton about his new book, The Mystery of Scarab Ray, Neolithic Scotland and the Origins of Ancient Egypt. How are you doing, Laird?
I'm doing great today, Soraya. How are you doing?
All right. And now, initially, this book was going to be called something else.
Yes, it was originally going to be called The Overthrown Boat. And the reason it was going to be called that is because, for one thing, the Egyptian correlate words to Scarab Ray mean overthrown boat. And there are other symbolic references, cosmological references that tie into the notion or trying to be conveyed with the image of a capsizing boat. And so that phrase seemed to go with the material, the same as point of origin. The phrase kept turning up in the research of the material.
Okay. And was this your idea to change the name or the publisher?
No, this was the publisher's, and I'm actually happy with the title they came up with. I think it's a better title than I had in terms of posturing it for the public. This is something that authors go through. It's sort of a push-pull with the publishers, that every author has an idea of what their book ideally ought to be called, and every publisher has a different idea of what it should be called.
And Scarab Ray is one of those things that lately has been popping up in my Facebook feed as, you know, this farmer found this mysterious dwelling on the beach. You know, click here to see what it was. And, you know, that's the whole Scarab Ray story. So it's something that's sort of viral at the moment.
Yeah, it is. Actually, I'm lucky to be just a little bit ahead of the curve, which is nice.
And do you want to give people a little history of Scarab Ray, how it was found and stuff?
Sure. Scarab Ray is traditionally understood to have been the first farming village in Neolithic Northern Scotland. This is around 3200 BC. It sort of followed on a tradition of single family farms that appeared there around 4000 BC. And the site had been covered over for many years, naturally covered over. It had been abandoned around 2600 BC and then covered over by, some sources say natural forces, some say deliberately buried. And it remained buried for thousands of years until the middle of the 1800s when a series of storms uncovered a piece of it. Now, it happened to be sitting on the land of a gentleman by the name of the Laird of Scotland. His title was the Laird of Scotland, actually the Laird of Scale is what it is. There's a bay there called Scale. And he devoted 8 years of his life and a large part of his fortune to making sure that the site got excavated carefully, bringing in reputable people to try to determine who these people were and what they had been about. Ultimately, the researchers there don't really have a theory as to who the people were. There's not a lot of evidence there to be able to base an opinion on, but they do know that the architecture doesn't really tie to local things, to regional things. The ancient language there doesn't tie to regional things. The pottery doesn't tie. There are a lot of question marks, but not a lot of answers. So I got brought into the process sort of against my will. A long-distance friend sent me an email asking if I thought there might be Egyptian influences at Scarabray. My reaction to that was, well, I don't know very much about this region of the world to begin with. I know nothing that would really pertain to the question, but I've learned over time to pay attention to questions like that and turn up. It eventually occurred to me that I believe that the Dogon were Egyptian during that era at about 3200 BC. And the Dogon have done a really good job of preserving their traditions. And so I thought maybe I could find commonalities between what we see at Scarabray and what the Dogon do. And that ended up sort of being key to unlocking things. The first piece, I sort of approached it from a generalized standpoint. I took a look at the village as a whole and said, is there any way this resembles a Dogon village? And outwardly, it actually does. They're built according to a similar process using, there's a lot of drywall stone construction where flat stones are placed without mortar to be able to make walls and buildings and things like that. But stylistically, there are some similarities too. The heights of the walls are similar. They allow passageways between buildings that are similar. And there are structural similarities to some of the structures that were built there. There's one in particular. There's a sort of a rounded chamber at Scarabray that takes very much the same form as a very important Dogon structure. This is a discussion house that's part of every Dogon village. The rule in a Dogon village is that if any two people have a dispute, they're required to go to this discussion house, and they're required to remain there until they've worked it out. And if there's more than two people involved, then everybody who has an interest in the dispute has to go there. And that helps keep Dogon villages a very peaceful place. Well, they can see at Scarabray that Scarabray was also apparently a very peaceful place. They find no evidence of weapons, no evidence of fortifications or defensive structures of any kind. It looks like it was a very peaceful farming region.
Okay.
So those broad commonalities brought us down to the questions of the Dogon houses themselves. The Scarabray houses themselves. And that's sort of a little bit of a confused issue because over the period of 600 years, all but one of the structures at Scarabray has been rebuilt. But archaeologists can see that the original houses that were there were all built to the same plan. And this plan has some features that the local researchers consider to be unique. One of those is a rounded room at one end of the house that they refer to as a sort of a beehive cell shape. And the house includes two rectangular rooms on the sides, a square room in the center, and sort of a rectangular entryway at the bottom, along with this rounded room that they're not sure whether it was used for. So I did some research, and the Dogon live in a desert region of Mali right now, and so they largely build from mud. They can put mud houses together and they hold their form because it's so dry there. But when they build stone houses, they build them to a specific plan, and it's very much a match for what you see at Scarabray. And better than that, they have a reason why they build it that way. There's cosmology, there's symbolism that's associated with that plan. The plan represents the body of a sleeping woman or potentially a sleeping goddess in some cultures. This is a theme that crosses cultures. But the round room represents her head, the side rooms her arms, the central cavity her body cavity. At the lower entryway represents her sexual parts. Now, one difference in the two house plans is that at Scarabray, it looks, I mean, I approached this thing believing that I was looking at influences from ancient Egypt to northern Scotland. And so I thought it was interesting that when the plan was implemented at Scarabray, they added a hearth right in the spot where a heart should be. So they added it in keeping with the symbolism. And I thought that was pretty interesting that someone would have thought to do that. It wasn't until later in my studies that too many things started not making sense in that perspective. And I decided to look at it the other way and realized that the whole picture makes better sense if that hearth was a part of the original plan that the Dogon removed when they moved to an area of the world where they didn't need a hearth in the house.
Okay. Now, is there any chance that some of these similarities are just common sense building techniques?
Some of them are. I mean, anybody who builds tries to construct out of flat stone like that is going to produce things that resemble this. But what the commonality of the two house plans did for me was it gave me a basis to argue that, or at least to investigate whether Dogon and Egyptian language has any bearing on the site, and the Dogon and Egyptian symbolic cosmology has any bearing on the site and the region. And so when you start asking those questions, then all sorts of interesting things turn up. On Orkney Island, you have a series of place names that the local researchers have no etymological root for. They don't know where the word came from. I mean, even the word Scotland, the word Scott, has no established etymological root. They don't know why it's called Scott. So you have these series, besides this farming village during the 600 years that it was inhabited, you also have a series of related megalithic sites that were constructed that had to have been built to a cross-generational plan because they were built over the period of 600 years. And they were connected in Neolithic times by a road that led to this Scarabray village. So you can understand, because the road was there, that this was conceived of as a single conceptual thing. I mean, these are related structures. Now, the local researchers don't really have a theory as to why those megalithic sites were placed the way they were or why they took the form that they did. But when we look at Dogon cosmology, where they're talking about stages of creation in relation to how matter forms in particular, you can see that the megalithic sites repeat a sequence of shapes that are cosmological. From the Dogon perspective, they represent stages that matter goes through as it forms. So then that opens up the possibility of looking at the place names that go along with those sites and seeing if those make sense cosmologically. And in the end, they do. You can, using the Dogon dictionary or the Egyptian dictionary or both, you can present a rationale why each of these places were named what they were named. I'll give you an example. There's a site called the Standing Stones of Stennes. This is a stone circle. Now, I know on the basis of ancient cosmology that one of the functional purposes of a stone circle was it served as a calendar, an agricultural calendar. It was a way of distinguishing when to plant and when to harvest. Now, in the Egyptian hieroglyphic language, there's a word, sten, that means to distinguish between winter and summer. And so it has meanings that pertain to a calendar and makes sense in terms of the stone circle being at the site that it's at. You have other interesting things. You have a Scottish word, ness. These sites are located interspersed with bodies of water called nesses. Now, from the Scottish perspective, a ness represents the concept of a nose. They're talking about the the point of land that sticks out into the water. From the Egyptian perspective, a nes represents a tongue. They're talking about the tongue of water that reaches around the edge of the land. And so etymologically, both words have the same potential relationship to describing the sites. I mean, they could equally well describe the site that these things are at. And as you go along from place to place, there are Dogon and Egyptian words that clarify why this thing was built where it was and what the purpose of the structure might have been.
Okay. Now, this area was actually above, it was not under ice during the last ice age. Is there any chance this site is actually older than it seems to be?
Probably not, because they know for certain that agriculture was happening here. And around 3200 BC, there was a sudden warming of climate on Orkney Island. So it makes sense that if agriculture was happening here, it would have happened during a period that was warmer, not a period that was chilly. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, chances are, based on the records we have right now, it was too cold to have served that purpose. But an interesting perspective on it is, if we entertain the idea that these megalithic sites were cosmological and that there was a road that connected them, then you essentially had a situation on the island where a person could literally walk through the stages of how matter forms to get to the village. And that implies an instructional site. Now, that's in keeping with Dogon perspectives, where their cultural memory is that their cosmology was instructed to them as in conjunction with agriculture in ancient times. And they have all sorts of traditions that are in keeping with what we find at Scarabrea and on Orkney Island. One of the more interesting outlooks on it is that the Dogon stages of matter don't stop at the equivalent of the Scarabrea village, which represents sort of a cluster of collapsed dimensions that in string theory and in the ancient cosmological view represent the first finished, you know, coherent structure of matter. This is a structure that supposedly exists at every point in space and time. But the Dogon conception of these stages continues on upward from there all the way to the atom. And so one of the questions I asked was, could there have been an attempt to represent the next stage beyond that cluster of houses? Well, the next stage for the Dogon represents, it corresponds to the idea of fundamental particles forming against what astronomers called a background field. And from the Dogon perspective, they symbolize that with an actual agricultural field, that every year before they plant their crops, they go to the field of their highest priest, who's called the Aru priest, and they draw a field drawing that's not unlike a crop circle. In the field, it's a circle with zigzag lines in it that represent vibrations of matter. So knowing that at 3200 BC, the Dogon would have been Egyptian, for that to have been reflected at Scarabrea, we would have had an Egyptian concept that goes along with it. So I started researching that, realized that one of the Egyptian words for field is Sekhet. And there is a tradition called Sekhet Eru that would go along with the field of the Dogon field of the Eru priest. But Sekhet Eru is a term for the field of reeds, which was an Egyptian concept that eventually became associated with heaven. It's the concept that the Greek outlook on the Elysian fields came out of. So the Egyptians have all sorts of information about the Sekhet Eru. It's part of the Egyptian Book of the Dead. It's the subject of very many, you know, paintings, wall paintings, and things like that in Egyptian culture, where the deceased pharaoh is understood at the point that he dies, his spirit is said to return to this place, the field of reeds, the Sekhet Eru, where the pharaoh happily works cultivating agriculture and performing work in the agricultural fields. And there are paintings of animals that supposedly populate, and plants and so forth, that supposedly populate the Sekhet Eru. And they're all animals and plants that are indigenous to Orkney Island. When you follow that down to the Greek tradition of the Elysian fields, The Greeks do the same thing that the Dogon and the Egyptians do. They treat this concept of Elysian Fields on two simultaneous levels. On one level, it represents a cosmological concept that's just theoretic or mythical. But it also represents an actual real-world field that somebody works and plants. And so from the Greek perspective, when they're describing their Elysian Fields, they place it at the edge of the Western Ocean, just as Orkney Island is placed. They describe it as being a place of great winds, which is the characteristic feature of Orkney Island. They describe it as being sort of interspersed with bodies and rivers, sort of streams of water, just as Orkney Island is. They even refer to it by the Greek term Okeanos, which is phonetically very similar to Orkney Island. So there is reason to think that just as Schliemann was able to follow what originally looked like a mythic trail to find a historical Troy, that it might be possible to follow geographic hints given in Greek texts to Orkney Island and place what seemed to be mythical as a geographical place.
Hmm. Okay. Now, when you talk about the Dogon, talking about their cosmological beliefs, was this something you interpreted out, or did the guy who lived with them there that originally wrote about them come to these conclusions, or did they tell him that this is what it was?
Well, to give you a little background on that, in my field of comparative cosmology, the biggest threat or obstacle to a person like me who compares these things is their own wishful interpretation. And so you have to guard against that. And so one of the rules that I make is that interpretations need to begin with a clear statement on the part of the cultures themselves, not me. So the statement that the Dogon symbolism represents how matter forms comes from the Dogon priests. They flatly say that their symbolic system describes how their tribal god Ama created matter. And that was actually my entry point into this whole book writing business, was realizing that what they were describing at the top levels of matter, they were describing something that looked and sounded very much like an atom that was comprised of things that looked and sounded, and even drawings that relate to concepts of electrons and protons. It looked like they had a scientifically correct outlook at the very top of this series of stages. So I ask myself, well, knowing that these two top stages look correct, what are the chances that this long descending series of stages might also be scientifically correct? And I started educating myself about scientific theories of how matter forms, and realized you can lay all this stuff side by side. You can place a Dogon description next to a description from Stephen Hawking, and the related Dogon drawing next to a diagram from Stephen Hawking, and it's an intuitive match. And so the Dogon are describing a process by which particles form essentially from waves, which is very much the scientific outlook, and they have the intervening stages right. So it's in my training, scientific training as a kid in school, I was taught that when you bump up against the third coincidence, it's time to consider that something other than coincidence might be going on. Well, here we have sort of an endless chain of coincidences where for the Dogon to be right about this and not have it be based on science is almost unthinkable.
Okay. Now, but at the same time, doesn't it require something like string theory to be correct, which is definitely a disputed field at this point?
It aligns in some ways with string theory. It actually aligns with a version of string theory called torsion theory. But the Dogon system actually goes deeper than what the astrophysicists are traditionally talking about. And that one of the problems I had in discussing the Dogon tradition is that there are three or four stages at the bottom of the construct the Dogon have that didn't align with anything that the astrophysicists were talking about. But not that the astrophysicists had a different view of it, it's that they just don't go there. This is a range of discussion they don't conduct. And so one of the upcoming books that I'll be publishing deals with that range of stuff that happens before, actually it precedes the wave to particle sort of construct. It talks about where does this stuff really come from, and it tries to reconcile archaic philosophies of how creation happens with theories of scientific theories that have not yet really been fully integrated as to how those processes might happen.
Okay. Do you want to get into a little bit of the Dogon concept of reality and how it works?
Sure. From the Dogon perspective, it's a lot like the Buddhist perspective. The Dogons say that material reality as we perceive it constitutes a sort of a reflected image. The Dogons say it's a correct reflected image. It's like a shadow or a reflected image of a reality that exists at a more fundamental level in the form of waves. Now, that idea is something that's not all that hard for us to grasp. If you understand that every day when you open your laptop computer, that what exists in the form of waves at your Wi-Fi router turns into what looks like an image on your computer screen. Same thing with broadcast TV. What was broadcast as a program in the form of waves would be converted into an image when you turned on your TV set. Now, you turn off your TV set and that reality doesn't go away. The show is still being broadcast. You turn off your laptop, the Wi-Fi doesn't go away. It's just you're not receiving it, you're not looking at it. From the Dogon perspective, that's the way matter works, that an act of perception, just as Heisenberg says, when a wave is perceived, that act of perception has to disturb it. And disturbing the wave sets off sort of a chain reaction that is as natural a process as water freezing into ice. So their outlook is that we're not really seeing directly the reality that we believe exists, but that we are seeing a fairly accurate presentation of what the underlying reality is.
Okay, and they also have the whole observer effect down.
They understand that that observing the thing is the act that sets off sort of catalyzes this chain reaction that produces what we see as matter. But that from their perspective, it's happening sort of in real time. It's converting the same way that when you turn on your PC, you in real time you see those waves being converted into images. It's happening so quickly that we don't notice it. But if your response time slows down on your computer, you might see an image form in sections rather than immediately. And so a person can understand that what we're seeing is really a projected image, not an actual full image. There's a time frame difference. If it weren't happening as quickly as it were, it wouldn't look real to us. And the same thing is true about matter. That Einstein says that the more massive an object is, the slower its time frame is. And so if we're dealing with virtually massless waves, it makes sense that the time frame that those exist in is a much, much quicker time frame, an ultra-quick time frame, compared to what we exist in. And so if an act of perception disturbs that wave, that faster than we can measure or perceive, that wave is transformed into a particle, and it's happening so quickly, you know, essentially sort of like Magneto raising steps up in front of him as he walks out across the air, that reality is being created in front of us faster than we can perceive it being created, and so we never have a chance to understand that it's not really there.
Is this, would you say it's similar at least to the holographic idea of reality?
Yeah, it definitely is similar to, but with different slants of perspective as to why it happens. The traditional place that most researchers I hear who are talking about that go to is they see our reality as being a simulation, that ours is a simulation inside of a computer. The Dogon agree that what we're seeing isn't real, but they don't agree that that's the ultimate cause of what's going on. The problem is that try to get down to what they do believe is the ultimate cause of what's going on is sort of a book-length explanation.
Right.
You have to very carefully lay foundation. As a matter of fact, it's a complicated enough process that I worked up a PowerPoint presentation for myself to explain it to somebody, just because you have to get the pieces in the right order for it to hold water, to make sense.
Okay. Now, the Dogon and the Buddhists talk about dealing with these sort of, I guess we could say, supernatural beings that taught them this cosmology, taught them agriculture and some such things like that. Now, do you connect these to the same beings that are known as the Anunnaki?
No, not really. Okay. Well, I mean, yes and no. My approach to it isn't through the Anunnaki. In my first book, I talk about some of the terms that relate to the Anunnaki are really, from the Dogon perspective, they relate to cosmological concepts of how biological reproduction happens. Mm. So there's a reason to think that some of that might have been not interpreted from the right perspective. There's a tough problem with trying to distinguish what's mythical or cosmological from what is actual factual statement. There are ways of getting at it, but you mostly have to get at it through comparative methods. If you approach it from one perspective, it's hard to anchor in a perspective and say, this must be mythical, this must not be. In talking about ancient Chinese emperors, there are myths that survived of the lives of these emperors. But the myths, when you examine the myths talk about what the emperor's name was and where he was born and what places he visited and what civilizing skills he brought to humanity and what things he's remembered for having accomplished. The problem is that if you compare each of those subjects to the Egyptian words that represent those subjects, you see that they're all homonyms of each other. They're all homonyms of a cosmological term. And so looking at it in retrospect, there's a perspective from which this is just a way of presenting multiple meanings of a cosmological term in a way that can be remembered. It's a mnemonic device that's half of the conundrum. The other half is that there are other perspectives from which it looks like it might be historical. So that plays out in terms of things like the story of Moses' exodus from Egypt. There are reasons to say that's an entirely mythical storyline. There are also reasons, just as valid reasons, to say that it looks like it's historical. Hmm. You get into this sort of yin-yang of that stuff. But as far as the mythical beings themselves, there's a rationale for understanding that somebody not human may have been involved with things in ancient times, besides the fact that every culture talks about that. From my perspective, I have two cosmological systems that are a match for each other today. One is a Buddhist symbolic system that goes with the Buddhist stupa, and the other is the Dogon symbolic system that goes with an aligned shrine the Dogon have called a granary. They're, a stupa and a granary are essentially the same forms. They evoke the same architectural plan, same shapes and the same sequence associated with the same symbolism. From my perspective, it's the same structure, even though it plays out a little differently. Now, these two systems are given in different languages, one in Sanskrit and one in what are essentially Egyptian hieroglyphic, or the equivalent of Egyptian hieroglyphic words. The Dogon don't write them, they just speak them. But because the systems are given in different languages, it's fair to conclude that one culture didn't just adopt their system from the other one wholesale. They're given in entirely different languages. The Buddhist system was documented by 400 BC, so we know it's ancient. And the Dogon system is given in Egyptian words that went out of use by about 750 BC, and it reflects values that arguably go back to around 3000 BC that we can point to. So what that says to a researcher like me is, for those two systems to still be a match today, neither one of the systems can have changed significantly over thousands of years. Each culture somehow managed to keep a very complex system of symbols straight for thousands of years, independently of each other. Now, the Buddhists say that they got their most sacred symbols from a non-human source. They flatly say it. And the Dogon flatly say they got their symbolic system from a non-human source. But they go a step further in saying that not only was it not human, but it was also originally non-material. Now, we know that what they're describing as a non-material source must have played out in a physical a material realm or a material frame, because their teachers were concerned about what bad effects their presence could potentially have on the Dogen. And their solution to that was to sequester just a few tribespeople, 8 tribespeople, at a time in a remote location. Sounds a lot like 8 chambered houses on Orkney Island. And instruct those 8 in a system of cosmology that was tagged to a system of agriculture. From a civics point of view, the goal was to raise humanity upward from a level of hunter-gatherers to a level of farmers. And from a cosmological perspective, they were trying to help us understand our humanity's true relationship to the larger processes of creation, because they felt that having a correct understanding of that would help us to make the right choices for ourselves.
Okay.
So given all of that, I can conclude that the Buddhists and the Dogen either both somehow managed to keep these complex systems entirely straight for thousands of years, but then somehow both misremembered who they got it from in the matching ways. Doesn't sound very likely to me. Or I can conclude that they also kept that last detail straight, and that as a researcher I have to allow the possibility that there could have been non-human influences back in ancient times.
Okay. Is it possible that these civilizing influences are the same beings that people connect with, like shamans connect with, in altered states of consciousness?
I think that it is. I mean, there are all sorts of things that point to that. From an archaic perspective, universes form in pairs. And this is the Dogen outlook, too, that our material universe has a twin universe that is non-material and that we don't readily perceive. And that the non-material universe is characterized by having perfect knowledge but an inability to act, whereas the material universe has imperfect knowledge and full ability to act. And so in that mindset, there's sort of this cosmic game of charades going on, where the non-material side is able to give little clues to the material side to try to induce particular actions that it can't take for itself. And on the material side, these play out in the form of vivid dreams, things that look like coincidences, unusual behavior of animals, divination, clairvoyance, and things like that. And so on the material side, for the people who pick up on certain of these seeming coincidences not being coincidences, or who pick up on a vivid image of a dream as something they should follow up on, then those people become sort of progressively more aware of the existence of this non-material twin. And other people who don't pick up on those things don't.
Okay.
Now, we have scientific reason to think that there is a realm that we don't detect. I compare it to the blind spot in your car. If you were the driver of our learning how to drive, and nobody ever explained to you that there's a blind spot created by your mirrors, you might go through your whole driving life never really realizing that there's space there to hide a Mack truck. Well, science points to the fact that these kinds of blind spots may exist for us also, and one direct way that points to it is a kind of fundamental particle. Fundamental particles are categorized by scientists and by the Dogen based on their symmetry. And there's certain kind of particles that look the same from all sides, certain kinds that have to be turned halfway around to look the same, certain ones that have to be turned all the way around to look the same, and a fourth kind called half-spin particles that have to be turned around twice to look the same. Now, it's hard to explain why you would have to turn something around twice before it looked the same. One explanation is that it passes into and out of a realm that we don't see, a blind spot. So that clues that sort of opens a door to the Dogen perspective and to the archaic perspective that there might be more going on here than science recognizes, and that some of the rules that scientists create for themselves have the effect of perpetuating that blind spot. You get down to questions, where do dimensions come from? Or where and we have something called virtual particles that sort of pop into and out of existence. Scientists don't address the question of what it means to be out of existence. There are a whole list of these questions that when you bump up against them, science has sort of a bullshit answer in response to it that doesn't actually explain the thing. And that just like small children come to accept that the truth doesn't, they eventually figure out the truth fairy doesn't, there are these fundamental assumptions at the basis of astrophysics that aren't fully dealt with. And those are the places where the Dogan perspective fits.
Okay. All right. Now, one of the things you talk about is Bernard's loop and how the Dogon understood Bernard's loop as something different than what we do.
Well, from the Hermetic standpoint, one of the catchphrases of this cosmology is as above, so below, which is suggesting that the process work in the macrocosm are in some way fundamentally similar to the processes that work in the microcosm. Now, the Dogon have a tradition like the Egyptians did of placing large stones on a plateau to represent stars. And among those stars, in particular, are the belt stars of Orion. And the Dogon say their purpose in placing those stars to represent the belt stars is to draw our attention to a structure that they refer to as the Chariot of Orion. This is, in their descriptions, they don't actually tell us what that structure is. And the French anthropologists who studied them presumed they were talking about the entire constellation of Orion. And they depict the Chariot of Orion as being that entire constellation. But the descriptions the Dogon give, they say that the structure they're describing is a conceptual correlate to this fundamental structure of matter that exists at every point in space and time. Now, there are several different ways of characterizing that structure. One way of looking at it is like the initial bubbles that you blow from a bubble wand that are two, where there isn't quite enough tensile strength in the soap yet to hold the shape of the bubble, and so the first ones pop. And eventually you get enough soap on the wand that you create a bubble that holds a shape and it floats off. Well, the Dogon see these clusters of matter the same way, that as this catalyzing process from waves happens, that these bubbles of mass get created that end up collapsing and forming these structures. Another way of looking at those eight bubbles is as eight rays of a star of increasing length that emerge from a single point. And another way of characterizing it is with the spiral that can be drawn to inscribe the endpoints of those rays that come out from the central point. So the Dogon tried to explain this process, this is a little tricky to explain. The Dogon have a character in their myth called Ogo, who plays the role of light. And Ogo's job, one of his jobs, is he measures out the universe in 8 billion steps. Now, I know that the word step is sort of a code term for a cubit in the archaic tradition. That's because one of the ways you can measure a cubit is with the average pace or step of a person. I also know that the universe doesn't measure 8 billion cubits wide. It's much bigger than that. But one of the routine figures that's given for the size of the observable universe is 8 billion light years. And so in the Dogon myth, it looks as if somebody was trying to set up a correspondence between cubits and light years. Well, you go to the Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionary, Budge's dictionary, and one of the words he gives for a cubit is akumeh, or light measure, or light cubit. So then you ask yourself, how is it that we know how big a cubit is? Well, we inferred the size of an Egyptian cubit from the dimensions of the Great Pyramid, that the Great Pyramid measures 440 cubits per side of its square base and 280 cubits high. So given these sort of disparate pieces of information, I was trying to figure out what the Dogon were talking about. And I went to Google and I keyed into the search line 440, 280, and Orion, because I know my friend Robert Bovall feels that the pyramids at Giza represent the belt stars of Orion. And when I pressed enter on Google, what it brought back to me were references to Barnard's Loop, which is a spiraling birthplace of stars that centers on the belt of Orion. Its light is so faint that we can't see it readily. We can only image it through time-lapse photography. But when we do image it, it looks like the wheel of a chariot that Orion the Hunter is standing in. So now we found our chariot of Orion. Then better yet, the dimensions of that spiral are given as 440 light years by 280 light years. So now we have a perspective here. Okay. Moreover, from a scientific standpoint, Barnard's Loop represents a stellar bubble. And the way it forms is precisely the same way that the Dogon say their little structure of matter forms. You could trade the Dogon descriptions for scientific descriptions, and you have they're interchangeable. This is the same structure on a macrocosmic level that the Dogon are describing for the microcosm. It's one of the spectrum of what happens below. So any culture that talks about a wheel or a chariot that associates with Orion, we know without even checking that they have to have been influenced by the same system of cosmology. This is too random a reference to have just come up with accidentally.
Now, you talk about the possibility of a pole shift in regards to Barnard's Loop. How would that relate?
Okay, so my friend Walter Cruttendon believes that the motion of precession isn't caused by a wobble in the Earth, as is traditionally thought. He thinks there's an actual physical rotation, like an orbit going on between the Earth and the Sirius stars that takes 24,000 or 25,000 years, action at a distance that scientists are reluctant to think that gravity is really capable of doing that. Now, Sirius is one of the few stars that doesn't precess. And that sort of supports what Walter has to say, because imagine yourself sitting on a merry-go-round as a child that's being spun with people standing around watching you. If there were a child sitting directly across from you on the merry-go-round, they wouldn't seem to be spinning while everybody else did. And that's sort of the effect we see with Sirius. But my perspective on it is a little different. Barnard's Loop is thought to have been the product of a supernova. But so is the second star in the Sirius system, a star referred to as Sirius B that is a dwarf star. It's the result of a supernova. So it's not unthinkable that both events created the same, a single event created both things. And if that's true, then what we might be seeing is that the rotation of this gigantic spiral would have enough gravitational effect to move our whole region of space around, and that's the effect that we're seeing. We're seeing the effect of a rotation of that spiral, not of a binary relationship between two stars. I think that perspective is a pretty reasonable one. There are a lot of references, ancient references, that point to that kind of a spiral being important.
And how might that trigger a pole shift?
Well, now that's a good question. If there are electromagnetic effects associated with the rotation of that spiral, then it's not unthinkable that eventually a conflict gets created between the magnetic field of the Earth and the magnetic field that's generated by this spiral that causes the planet to flip. I mean, you've seen magnets flip.
Mm-hmm.
If there's electromagnetism involved, it's not unreasonable to think that could happen. We see planets, even in our own system, where the tilt of the axis is the reverse of what and we can tell by the rotation of the planet that it's rotating the opposite direction from what we would expect. Looks like there might have been a flip.
Okay. All right. Let's move back into the main subject of the book, though, the Scar of Bray. I mean, it is and isn't the main subject of the book, although it's the focus of the book of figuring out a lot of it. You go into the history of the Dogon and Egypt and stuff like that. Now, one of the things you talk about is the Egyptian first time versus what you call the second time, which you think is connected to Skara Brae.
I see a series of influences on ancient Egypt that are part of what makes things complicated there symbolically. There are influences that look like they happened around 10,000 BC, a previous book called Point of Origin deals with Göbekli Tepe, the megalithic site in Turkey, southeast Turkey, that is traditionally dated to around 10,000 BC. If we entertain Robert Bovall's view that the pyramids of Giza align with the belt stars of Orion at 10,000 BC, and if we accept the idea that the Sphinx pointed to the constellation of Leo at 10,000 BC, then as a researcher, I only have two choices. Either those alignments were placed during the era of 10,000 BC, or else someone in a later era had the ability to retrospectively calculate what the alignments should have been. And so I net that out to there must have been direct influences on the region of Egypt at 10,000 BC. The carved sphinx, which is carved from a natural outcrop of rock, is one of the iconic practices of a very archaic tradition in India called the Shakti cult, a cult that shares all of the same symbolic elements that we see at Göbekli Tepe, even right down to the name of Göbekli Tepe itself. One of the traditional translations for that name is Potbelly Hill, while one of the iconic objects of the Shakti cult is a clay pot filled with water to represent a womb called the Potbelly. So you have lots of different connecting pieces there that make it look like we had may have had direct influences from Göbekli Tepe to Egypt at 10,000 BC. It looks like we have indirect influences that came through the Shakti cult through India and down into Egypt at Elephantine around 4,000 BC. And then we have a third set of influences based on the Scarabray site, centering on all the same cosmological ideas, all the same symbolic definitions, and so forth, that look like they came in to Egypt just before dynastic Egypt. It looks to me as if the foundations for agricultural-based kingships, which appeared around the world at 3100 BC, were worked out at this instructional sanctuary at Scarabray. And so at 3100 BC, suddenly you have a site in Egypt that's associated with the word Taru, one in China associated with the word Eru, one in Ireland associated with the word Aru, and one in South America associated with the word Peru. And those four words also have additional levels of meaning the same way as other cosmological words do. They can represent the four cardinal points of the planet, north, south, east, and west, or in Egyptian terms, sunrise, sunset, lower and upper. But they can also represent four progressive stages of agriculture, that one represents an unplanted field, another represents a planted field, a third one with a field cultivated with plants growing in it, and the last one, granaries with harvested grain stored in them. So that's one of the reasons to think that that supports the idea of influences from Scarabray to Egypt. We don't have an accepted theory of where the pharaohs came from. There are lots of linguistic and symbolic connections to Scarabray that could connect to the pharaohs. As an example, about 2600 BC, about the same time that the Scarabray site and the Orkney Island sites were being abandoned, we have a pharaoh come to power in Egypt who names himself Sene Pharaoh. And the word Sene means reflection or image of, and the word pharaoh is the word for pharaoh, but it's also the phonetic root of a place called the Faroe Islands that's located to the north and west of Orkney Island. It's a very well naturally protected group of islands that look like they could have been home to the group of mythical teachers who may have been responsible for the instructional sanctuary at Scarabray. Now, Sene Pharaoh in Egypt begins building pyramids. He's the first pharaoh to build pyramids. And he builds some oddly shaped ones. The first one, one of them is the bent pyramid, the one that changes angles halfway up that nobody can explain why did they do that. There's no clear engineering reason to have done it. There's no clear symbolic reason to have done it. Why did they do that? Well, I looked to the Faroe Islands and realized that one of the dominant, prominent peaks in the Faroe Islands does that same angle change at about the same point. You can lay the images side by side, they look alike. In fact, each of the four pyramids that Sene Feru built has a counterpart in the Faroe Islands that looks like it.
Wow.
So that's another connection. There are many other Egyptian connections that potentially link back. You know, in the Egyptian mindset, they link to the West. Now, modern Egyptologists have, in their infinite wisdom, decided that that refers to the west bank of the Nile, not to the west side of the continent of Europe. But the Greeks are telling us, hey, folks, they're talking about the west side of Europe, not something closer. And we know the Egyptians had boats that were capable of going back and forth. We also know that anybody from an instructional side who might have been talking about how matter forms and had positive knowledge about that probably didn't have a difficulty traveling around wherever they wanted to go.
Fair enough. Now, Peru... you make the connection that is the fourth place, Peru.
Right. Now, I haven't shifted my focus to a book that explores any of the cultures in Peru, the possibility that Corral is one. Each of the other three cultures was also associated, the kingships were associated with lions and images of lions. Whereas in South America, you don't really have lions to be able to do that with, but Corral is associated with a large cat that's lion-like. So, hard to say. It looks to me the timing is right. DNA studies on Orkney Island show it to be one of the most diverse genetic places on the planet, including genetic links to the North Africans and the Egyptians. And no one really can explain why that is. That there's no traditional explanation for why Northern Scotland should be that diverse.
Now, when there are two groups that are mainly credited with having settled that island where Scarabray is, but let's talk a little bit about the Picts and the Peti.
The earliest Scandinavian reports from Orkney Island, they say that two groups were found living side by side on the island. The first was a group of pygmies of very strange habits, and the second was a group of clerics who always wore white, who the Scandinavians described as being so different from the Scandinavians as to constitute a different race rather than a different profession. The Dogon are a priestly tribe who traditionally wore white. Their teachers are referred to by the word pneumo, which is a counterpart to Egyptian words pneuma, which can mean waves perceived, basically. It's one of the things that repeats the idea of something non-material becoming material. But there's also an Egyptian word for pygmy that's given as nem or nema. And the word is actually written with little glyphs that look like pygmies. So we have a suggestion here that maybe the Scandinavians had encountered the mythical, the Dogon myth of their own instruction on this island in the presence of their materialized teachers. Within the UK itself, it looks like that group, both of those groups ended up abandoning Orkney Island around 2600 BC, and we don't really pick up a trail of anybody until we get down to the era of the Picts. And we have conflicting descriptions of who the Picts were, who they might have been. Some descriptions make it sound like they were pygmies. Others say, no, we've seen graves and we understand that they were average-sized people, not pygmy people. But there are all sorts of traditions that connect them with the fairy culture, fairy tradition in the UK. Part of what my next book, which is about, the focus is on New Zealand in a later era, part of what it does is it compares myths of these pygmies or the little people leaving Ireland to myths in New Zealand of pygmies or of the groups arriving there. And they're sort of, from the Irish point of view, they left across, by one myth they left across the Western Ocean, by another myth they went to the underworld. From the New Zealand point of view, they came across the Eastern Sea by boat. And an ancient name for New Zealand means first circle of the underworld. So both Irish perspectives are sort of upheld. There are also all sorts of architectural comparisons to be made, and language comparisons, and all sorts of different things that make those connections. But so conceptually, I trace the petty teachers of the Dogon, who were called Papae, who may relate to the later idea of popes in Catholicism. I trace these teachers down south from, as having headed partly south from Orkney Island into Scotland and Ireland and the UK. There are indications that they may have also eventually ended up other places. There are lots of connections to, say, the Hopi Indians in the U.S. There are connections to Indian tribes in the southeast of the United States and the region of Ohio and places like that. There are connections down into Central America and South America and into Polynesia.
Okay, then. That's going to be a lot of books for you.
I won't run out of things to write about.
You mentioned briefly in here that the teachers of the Dogon needed to be near water.
That's the one of the descriptions that the Dogon give of their teachers, is that they had a need to be near water. It looks to me as if they also needed to be in a particular relationship to electromagnetics, because they tend to place themselves on island groups that are located a certain distance from the pole. We see at Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, the climate warms suddenly just before we see evidence of structures there. On Orkney Island, the climate warms suddenly just before we see evidence of structures there. In New Zealand, the climate warms suddenly just before we see evidence of the pygmies there.
Hmm.
That may not be accidental. We may see these groups moving because of physical requirements. They had to be in a particular relationship to climate.
So could that also explain why so many of these monuments are built on the same latitude lines?
That could be. I think that may be a separate question, although there are complex things going on with those structures. And I don't have an absolute fix on what the purposes of the structures were, but there are Egyptian myths that suggest that things were able to be transported back and forth between structures. That if we think of non-material beings somehow being able to materialize and interact with us in a material frame, there had to be a mechanism for them to have materialized. And it's possible those structures were connected with that. These are all fall in the category of open questions for me. I don't have enough knowledge to be able to say definitively this is what happened.
Okay, all right. Is there any other mention of why they needed to be around water anywhere?
There are symbolic reasons, because there are cosmological connections between the concept of the pneumo being described as a perfect twin pair, and a hydrogen atom where the electrons are, or where two hydrogen atoms in a molecule of water represent the perfect twin pair.
Hmm.
So, again, this gets into the fuzziness of trying to separate what was purely a cosmological statement or a mythological statement from what was really a historical one. But it does look to me as if this group of teachers needed to be near water. I'm interested to find out if what the real geography was of Göbekli Tepe at 10,000 BC, whether there it was more water-like than it is today. Mm. There are some suggestions that the structures there are connected with water.
Huh. So basically what you're suggesting is Skara Brae was actually the first site that then spread out across these different areas of the world.
Well, I think Göbekli Tepe was, 7,000 years earlier, was really the starting point of it. That you can trace, virtually every civilizing skill the Dogon say they were taught appears first in the Fertile Crescent near Göbekli Tepe. It's farming, it's the first cultivated grains, the first domesticated animals, the first metallurgy, the first stone masonry, the first pottery, all of that appears in a short amount of time in the Fertile Crescent right at that spot. And then you can trace it spread outward from there with DNA, with language, with civilizing skills, civilizing practices. You can trace it in the era of 10,000 BC. It looks like it radiated from there. Now, I can see a trail of it down through India into Egypt. I can trace a trail of it up into Asia and across, even into the Americas. I mean, a Mongolian yurt is the same structure. There are different forms of yurts. One of them is a match for a Navajo roundhouse. One is a match for an American teepee, and it's actually called a teepee in Siberia or Mongolia. So you can see the trail of it there. I can understand that there must be a trail that goes from Turkey across Europe to Scandinavia and to northern Scotland. I just don't have a track of it yet.
Well, I guess what I meant is that in this second time that you postulate,
yes, it's the, not the second time. It looks like the first time. First of all, you wouldn't have to call it the first time if there'd only been one time. You don't have to call it the time. It's like the Hebrew scholars say that when the jealous God appears to Moses and says, you know, thou shalt have no gods before me, other gods before me, that statement implies that there were other gods.
Right.
Well, referring to something as the first time, which is what the Buddhists and the Egyptians do, implies that there was more than one time. And so I see the Scarabray site as being a secondary time, maybe not the second. There could have been other attempts in between that didn't work out. But it looks like the Scarabray instruction was the one that held, that took and held historically for us.
And so Egypt didn't influence Scarabray. Scarabray probably influenced Egypt.
Yeah, from my perspective, that's the case. 3200 BC is too early for... I don't think there's any researcher who believes that ancient Egypt could have mounted an expedition to northern Scotland at 3200 BC.
Okay. Now, the abandonment of Scarabray was... It's not saying that just kind of slowly dissipated. It was deliberately abandoned at a certain point.
Very, very abruptly, as a matter of fact. The people had enough warning that they seemed to have held a final feast. We know they had domesticated animals on the island, and it looks like that rather than leaving those animals to starve, they slaughtered them and had a feast. And at the end of that feast, they deliberately covered over the site of the feast. But before doing that, they had placed very carefully placed bones around the site. But not just any bone. These were bones, what they were placing were thigh bones. They were tibia. They were, and there's an Egyptian word for thigh or for tibia that also means to leave under duress or to depart under duress. So it was sort of left as a symbolic message. There were a couple of other symbols left there that give us a clue as to the fact that they were being forced to leave against their will because of an urgent circumstance. Not so urgent that they didn't have time to consider their animals, but urgent.
Okay. And you say some people think it may have been covered over deliberately, just like Göbekli Tepe?
Yeah, it looks like it was. I think that some of the sites there, it's clear that they were covered over deliberately. Others, it's ambiguous as to whether it was natural or deliberate. But deliberately covering it over, there's these structures, the spiral of matter that seems to be represented by megalithic sites on Orkney Island. One of the terms for that is an arc. And same thing with the Göbekli Tepe site. It associates linguistically with words that are pronounced arc in Egypt. Well, in Judaism, every morning, every temple is reading the same portion of the Torah scroll to their congregations. They bring the Torah scroll out, take a cover off of it, set it down, read the portion, roll it forward to the next portion, carefully cover it back over and place it back in the ark. And it's a cabinet called an ark, an Aron HaKodesh, that is abbreviated to ark. So there's an Egyptian word that means to cover over that's pronounced ark. So the act of covering over the site might be seen as a ritual that's comparable to the act of covering over the Torah and placing it back after an instructional episode has been completed properly.
Interesting. So we've touched on a small fraction of what you cover in this book. It's not a super long book. It's just under 200 pages, but you have packed full of information and evidence as to how you connect one culture to the other. It's an impressive piece of work. How long did it take you to write this one?
Actually, because of the way that my research goes, I end up with more loose ends than I do with usable material anytime I'm researching a book. Mm-hmm. In this case, the right fact came along and just pulled a whole book's worth of material together very, very quickly from those loose ends. It took about 6 weeks to research this. Hmm. And then the book was written over a period of months after that. But I knew where the book was going, and it had most of its form within about 6 weeks.
And have you found anything since then that has supported your ideas in this book or refuted them in any way?
Yeah, actually, a whole other book's worth of material came out of a visit that my son and I made in August to that region of the world. And there's just lots and lots of other material that connects in similar but different ways to the Egyptian stuff. Basically, if we can believe that there is a geographic connection between Egyptian mythical references to places in the West, we have a whole host of other names of places and descriptions of things that supposedly existed in the West from Egypt, and a lot of that ties to the same region.
Okay. And the book is The Mystery of Scarabray, Neolithic Scotland and the Origins of Ancient Egypt. What's up next, the one from New Zealand?
Yes. Now, my working title for that is Descent into the Underworld. Hmm. It's an exploration of basically Maori cosmology in New Zealand. Now, whether the publisher will keep that title or not, I don't know. From the perspective of the Irish, the pygmies that I equate to the Picts and the Pete left to go to the underworld, and the place I see them going is New Zealand. So it's sort of a direct connection to the same idea.
And when do you think that's going to see the light of day?
Well, contracts were signed today. So I imagine sometime this year, if Inner Traditions is true to their form, they'll probably aim for fall or this. The Scarabray book just came out in November. Could be the similar timing for the next one.
Okay. And you have another one on top of that that's mostly written, right?
Yeah. The one beyond that is written. It's really ready for submission. But it deals with fundamental concepts of creation. It's trying to make sense of pieces of the Dogon structure of matter that aren't normally discussed by astronomers when they're discussing matter, and trying to tie myths and science together to explain what those are.
Wow. So by the time those come out, you'll have another 5 books written after that?
Maybe not. We'll see. Things may slow down a little bit. I may take an opportunity to read something other than research material.
All right. Well, thank you, Laird. Where can people find you online?
Okay, the easiest place to find me really is Facebook. There is a LairdScranton.com site, but the contact tab from there does reach me, but that's a fan site. It's not really my site. The easiest place to find me is Facebook. Facebook message me, and usually I'm willing to answer a question or whatever, make contact with somebody.
All right, thank you so much, Laird.
Thank you.
All right, and as I said, there's a Patreon-only segment that will be up this week with Laird, and we're going to take you out with a song from Don O'Malley. This is The Bus Going Home.
Say what's going on. Read my mind, you might find that it's gone. But one thing's for certain, but one thing I know, we're all deluded about who's in control. We can think what we want about a higher soul, but our DNA is driving the bus going home. Going home. Ooh.
faster and faster. The time seems to go. The cradle seems only a minute ago. A life cut short by 100 or so. Our DNA's driving the bus going home. Going